Lucas on Life.
Hello, welcome to Lucas on Life. I'm Jeff Lucas, and at last, it's all over. Some of us are experiencing post-Olympic withdrawal symptoms, desperately missing the daily array of thrills and spills from the greatest athletes in the world. And others have huffed and puffed about the opening ceremony in Paris, felt rather bored but relieved when the closing ceremony took place. And apart from the rather delightful surprise in the arrival of Mr. Tom Cruise, have been quite unmoved by the whole event and are heartily glad it's all over. Perhaps most of us are somewhere in between. Turning to scripture, I think that if Paul the Apostle had lived in our day, he would have treated himself to a Sports Channel subscription, or perhaps he would have been a season ticket holder at his local football club. When I read through the letters that Paul wrote, his love for sports continuously comes through. Repeatedly, he borrows illustrations from the worlds of track, field, and boxing. Years of preparation went into the dazzling spectacle that captures the imagination of the world, the Olympics. Athletes have worked so hard, in some cases for decades, pushing themselves to their personal limits and beyond. They're captivated by the dream of Olympic glory. But tonight, I'm not going to talk too much about sport, interview any Olympians, or offer an opinion about a rather embarrassed pole vaulter who certainly did himself an unfortunate mischief. But as I think about the roar of the crowds in the stadiums, I'd like to encourage us to be more encouraging. And then, as we think about the diligence and discipline of the Olympic athletes, let's remind ourselves that we are all called to make healthy, disciplined choices. Then, finally, I'd love to introduce you to a rather special sportswoman called Doris. She certainly would have never made the Olympics, but in my view, she certainly deserved a gold medal. Tonight, Lucas on Life, let's reflect following the thrills and spills of Paris. The crowd. The man fiddled with his impossibly tight tie. His Sunday morning church attire was slowly strangling him. For a very long moment, he stood silent and then, at last, spoke to me without actually looking at me. His unsmiling face chilled words that really should have felt warm. "I need to thank you for your ministry, Jeff," he whispered hesitantly, apparently studying a fascinating object that hovered 3 feet above my head. He continued, "But then, we give all the glory to the Lord, don't we? I wouldn't want you to get proud." I thanked him and so wanted to deliver him of his constricting tie and of his hesitancy to encourage. I wanted him to know that Christian leaders are more likely to succumb to despair than to conceit. But he quickly fled, leaving me with a sad realization. In some churches, there's a famine of encouragement. Faithful, hard-working souls live in the suffocating atmosphere that pervades when appreciation is rare. Working hard in the hope of a final well done that will come when all is said and done, they live shriveled lives in the meantime. Starved of words that might spur them on, they hobble on. The assumption is that serving God is reward enough, which is quite wrong, because the God that we serve urges us to encourage one another. Encouragement transforms, energizes, empowers, as the glorious Olympics and Paralympics always demonstrate. The crowd is always the genuine all-rounder of the games, remarkably making a huge impact at every event. Commentators chatter about the home advantage or the fifth man in the boat that is the crowds. Athletes look wide-eyed and some openly sob as the crowds roar their support. The deafening choruses of support act like adrenaline, urging spent muscles and tired hearts onto greater exploits. Back when the Olympics were held in London, that was in 2012, a German journalist said that the London crowd deserved a gold medal. Sprinter Marlon Devenish, in an anti-doping campaign, announced that the crowd was his only drug. So why is the crowd the X factor that helps so many to meddle glory. More than a wall of noise, surely the crowd meets the athlete's primal need that we all share. That's the need to be noticed and approved of. As children, we crave the eye and encouraging words of a parent as we wobble on our bikes, bring home the chaotic painting from school, or use a toilet successfully. And encouragement is the fuel that can lift our heads through our darker days when the valleys are filled with shadows. This was poignantly demonstrated at one three-day event, a triathlon of sorts involving incredible physical stamina, steely mental fortitude, and emotional staying power. The demands were gargantuan, and so a team huddled together the night before the event, and their prospects weren't looking good because they were exhausted before they started. And then, the next day, the home crowd turned hostile. They switched allegiance, dumped their national hopeful, and cheered for a champion from another land instead. Their chant was an ominous betrayal. "We have no king but Caesar. Crucify that man." And so, on Transfiguration Mountain, the voice of the greatest encourager spoke loud and clear. "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." That voice had spoken before, just before another battle, this one for 40 days and nights, truly a marathon. "This is my beloved son. I am pleased with him." Spurred on by that encouragement, Jesus lived. Urged on by that familiar, encouraging voice, Jesus died. So let's go ahead, make someone's day, catch them doing something right, or search out the soul who's usually taken for granted. Thank the ticket collector on the train. Smile at the traffic warden. Write a note to that Sunday school teacher who has told the big story to countless squirming six-year-olds for decades. Some of them are in their 30s now, but perhaps few of them have come back to thank her. Let's win a gold medal as encouragers. It can be done. As we're reflecting post-Olympically, not sure that's a word, I recall that it was about 40 years ago when I made what I thought was the final decision. I am not an athlete, I concluded, and so physical exercise would not be part of my life. I would eat sensibly, drink moderately, but my ever-increasing shadow would not darken the doors of a gym. Those who worked out, I decided, were not mere mortals like me. And Olympic-level competitors, they were demigods, epic souls to admire, but impossible to emulate. This anti-fitness choice came after careful consideration of extensive data, like the fact that bending over to tie up my shoes took my breath away. And I also had a long history of being rubbish at anything remotely sporty. I still blush when I remember playing football during high school. Despite being placed in the defensive position of left back, I enthusiastically dashed all over the field for the first 5 minutes of the game until our irate and unnaturally chiseled sports teacher blew his whistle and, punctuating his question with swear words, asked me what I was playing at. I had no defense, literally, seeing as I was offside at the front of the field instead of being dutiful guarding the back of the field. I knew back then that I'd never be able to bend anything like Beckham. I hated rope climbing, mainly because I couldn't ever climb a rope, which is a shame because rope climbing was an Olympic event until 1932. Some say it's threatening to make a comeback. Even though I was moved when I read about the gold medal winning performance of Olympian George Ezer, who won the rope climbing event in 1904 and did it with just one wooden leg, I knew that even with two legs of my own, I'd be hopeless. And I was a chaotic jumble of bouncing limbs on the trampoline. I'd come last in the cross-country run and complained that oxygen was not provided. I was pretty good at cricket when it came to keeping score, but not playing. And so all of this led me to conclude, if sedentary living became an Olympic activity, I might stand a chance at victory, but until then, I had no hope. All of which makes me wonder, In what other areas of my life have I hoisted a white flag of surrender and submitted myself to a sentence of sameness? Have I unwittingly decided, like the proverbial leopard, that I can never change my spots? We, all of us, we make endless decisions, most of them subconsciously, about what we can and cannot do. And so we can write ourselves off from possibility and potential. Where have we decided that everything might change, but we can't change? Have we succumbed to that innocuous habit pattern, which is more annoying than perilous, or to the silent stalking of addiction, which doesn't send us an email to announce that we're trapped in its grasp? We don't pray because we think we can't pray. We don't risk because we think it's not in our nature. And we don't learn a new skill because we've decided it's too late. And often we're quite wrong. Some things that we think we can't do can be done. A few years ago, I decided to change my mind about me. Today, I can only look at the gathering Olympians with admiration, but most days, I speed walk between 2 and 4 miles. I lift weights, puff and pant on an elliptical, and occasionally hang upside down like a bat on a machine called an inverter, which is odd, but apparently has some benefits. I am healthier now at 68 than I was at 35, and it's due in part because I started to believe that I could live differently. If anyone should believe that we can change, we Christians should. We're the ones who believe that change doesn't just come from gritted teeth and sweat, but that the same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead is the transformer working within each of us. I'm also pleased to report that I've managed to showcase my trampolining skills for royalty. As a youngster, attending a youth club where Prince Philip was visiting, we were told to follow 2 vital instructions: bow when you meet him, and then carry on doing whatever you're doing because he wants to see a youth club in action. Bouncing away on the trampoline when the illustrious guest arrived, I was horrified when he headed directly to me, where my aerial display of flailing arms and legs all akimbo was not a pretty sight. But I learned something about royal etiquette that day. It's very hard to bow and bounce at the same time, but it can be done. It was a beautiful shot, the kind of heavenly volley that sends football commentators into verbal overdrive, a punt to launch a brace of slow-motion action replays. The ball rolled gently towards the player, who eyed it nervously at first. Tension crackled in the crowd. Suddenly, as if anointed by genius, the player stepped back on their right heel and performed a perfect kick. Hands outstretched, airplane-like, poise and balance perfect, foot connected perfectly with leather, with a deep, solid thud, scooping it up in a bend-it-like-Beckham power drive. It was surely sheer soccer poetry. Somewhere in the distance, a huge crowd rose to their feet as one and gave a deafening cheer. The player, lost in the moment, was oblivious to their roar of approval. The minister looked on, staggered. This was most unexpected, for this perfect kick was not performed in a stadium or a park, but in the main meeting hall, the sanctuary, some would call it, of a church in mid-Wales. It was late Sunday evening when it happened. Most of the congregation was enjoying that chatty cup of tea in hand fellowship, the warm afterglow ritual that caps 10,000 Sunday evening services. The minister watched on, feeling the pleasurable tired ache that comes when the sun sets on yet another busy Sunday. He was enjoying the clinking sound of china and the relaxed atmosphere. The service that had just concluded had been a happy affair. There'd been a refreshing cocktail of laughter and tears, and a challenge given that we should think about our faith and not just keep doing the same old things simply because, well, that's what we do. An atmosphere of grace pervaded. One of the children had been playing with a ball when it happened. The football rolled across the fading carpet to Josie, a sprightly lady of 70, faithful to God and to that church for the past 55 years. What would she do? Perhaps offer a gentle rebuke about the evils of soccer playing in church buildings? No, because Josie, she was the player. She eyed the ball hungrily, and for a few seconds she was 16 years old again and a member of the local girls' soccer team. She had loved the game dearly. Perhaps she was a local star. And then, as she put it, she got saved. She became a Christian. And in that day, fraternizing with what was called the world was not encouraged, and sports were considered to be worldly. To continue on the team would mean violating the prohibitionist doctrine of separation that was preached at the time. And so, with sadness, Josie hung up her soccer boots for the last time, and she had not kicked a ball for over half a century. There was no angst, and she was not bitter about her loss. She turned her back on the game and threw all of her energies into the life of the church. And then that late Sunday night ball appeared before her. As Josie said later, something from the past rose up from within me. So she performed a masterful kick. The minister's mouth fell open, first with amazement and then admiration. Josie explained later with a warm smile, "I realize now that a lot of things that we were told were sin, they weren't really sin at all." As I heard her story, I wondered about the countless Christians that I still occasionally meet for whom faith has been less than liberating. Too often I bump into good, kind, sincere believers who are passionately committed to a message of freedom, but who have been squeezed into the painful corsets of fear by second-hand, unthinking dogma. They are the ones who believe in joy but are nervous of laughter. It is they who occasionally doubt, as all humans do, but feel like they would be committing a Judas-like act of betrayal if they admitted their faith struggles. They are those for whom everything in life has to be productive, efficient, spiritually significant. They have tragically left spontaneity and play and simple, down-to-earth fun, like discarded toys of their childhood, rejected now for a stern, almost obsessive discipleship. They need to kick a ball, build a sandcastle, laugh out loud, face their uncertainties, giggle on a Sunday. And so, as I conclude this evening's program, Reflections from the Olympics and Sport in General, I wonder if perhaps heaven is waiting for some locked-up ones to get more of a life. And when some of us take those small steps of freedom, surely heaven notices, and somewhere in the distance, a huge crowd rises to their feet as one and gives a deafening cheer. And the player, perhaps lost in the moment, is oblivious to their roar of approval. See you next week.
Lucas on Life.